You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Wendy Feldman is a former financial advisor who was found guilty on three counts of securities fraud and forging false documents after she served 18 months in a federal prison camp, followed by a year in a halfway house. Wendy started her own business, a service called Custodial Coaching, which helps white-collar criminals do their time and reenter society reformed. Wendy Feldman joins us now to discuss it. Hello.
Hello.
Are there a lot of people offering this kind of service?
There are really not. There are a couple other people who say that they offer a similar service, but very different. I take a much more thoughtful, holistic approach rather than scaring people.
Well, you also bring experience to this. It's kind of like a former drug user who counsels people in rehab?
Exactly.
How much of what you do is based on your own experiences in prison?
It's all based on my experiences, whether my experience waiting to go to prison, at prison, after prison upon reentry, it's all my experience. It's the only way I think you can really learn that is to live it.
Well, you did commit a serious crime.
Yep.
The SEC charged you with stealing a little over $4 million from your clients, which included personal friends and even your parents.
That's true.
Were you unaware? I've thought about this with Bernie Madoff. Of course, his activities were on a larger scale.
Yeah.
But were you unaware that when you were doing this that it was almost inevitable that you'd eventually be caught?
Well, what I did was such a total there was a much larger part of it, and so this is one part. And that it always winds up happening that they charge you for the one thing that they can actually get you on. But to make it simple, this is what they said. I knew I would get caught. That wasn't the question. The question was, how do I get out of this and save myself and then kind of redeem myself? Because it was very out of character for me. And yet this is what happened through poor choices. It didn't happen, as with most of my clients, because of a need for money. It doesn't happen usually for greed. It happens for some sort of psychological reason that you go off track, and that's what happens with most of the people that I deal with, and in fact happened in my case. Once the machine gets going, it gets going.
So once you get started and you've taken some money from some people and gotten away with it, then, I'll take a little more?
No, it's how do I now put it back? And you can't put it back because you've already broken the law. So it's not about what else can I do wrong. It's about now what I've done something wrong, what can I do?
Do you think that spending time in prison is a good way to pay for one's crimes?
I think it depends on the crime. In certain types of crimes, I believe that it does help people. In very short sentences for white-collar crimes, I don't think serve any purpose. Longer sentences, maybe it gives you a time to think about what you've done and the choices you've made. Certainly in violent crimes, there has to be prison time, but there has to be another component, a rehabilitative component.
Well, did it serve a purpose with you? You were sent to a minimum security prison, which you've called the club.
Well, I mean, I didn't make that up because that's what everybody calls it.
Yeah.
But it did serve a purpose with me because, let me tell you, even though the surroundings aren't lock up in bars, you still don't have your freedom. You can't leave. You can't tuck your kids in at night. If you are somebody who's been very successful and you wind up there, you got to take a moment and think, how did I earn this ticket? And so it did serve a purpose with me. It actually did helped me a lot to sort things out because things in my personal life had gotten to such a level that that's where I was.
But you weren't sent to the kind of federal prison that more serious criminals are sent to.
Correct.
All of these people in your facility had committed white-collar crimes?
No, they were mostly drug crimes. Federal prison is mostly drug crimes. So I had people who had done all kinds of nonviolent drug crimes, meaning they didn't have a weapon with them. And that was the primary person who was there, drug crimes, drug trafficking. The white-collar people were less than 5%.
This is a federal prison. Where
yeah.
was it located?
In Phoenix, Arizona.
Are there some places that are better to do jail time in than others?
If you can go to federal prison and you can go to a camp, that's as good as it's going to get.
Uh-huh. And
they're
the worst?
Much the same. Well, I mean, a state prison that is not offering any programs that has no rehabilitative component, that's, you know, going to be the worst.
So what kinds of people do you work with? How do they even know that you offer this service?
I work with nonviolent offenders. So it could be somebody on a drug case. It could be somebody on a white-collar case. And they find me through various ways, either through their lawyers, through media that I've done, through a blog that I wrote called Notes from an Insider. And they also find me word of mouth and through some psychological professionals who refer to me.
Well, I can't imagine that these people have a lot of money. How much does your service cost?
Sometimes they have a lot of money. Usually it's the families who will pay. And I work on a sliding scale. So if I get somebody who I find who I know I can help and I can help change their life, you know, but they have no money versus somebody very wealthy who's just not going to listen to me. Sometimes those are the type of people you work with because that funds the people who you truly want to work with.
So you sometimes do pro bono.
I do a lot of pro bono. I have an affiliation with the Pasadena Police Department on their Mental Health Advisory Committee, and that's all pro bono. But the majority of my clients pay me or their, of course, it's a business, or their families do.
And you also have a team of criminal justice experts?
I have a pool of people that I work with who I think are tops in their field. So if somebody has a very serious psychological problem, I'll refer to that. If they need other types of therapy, I'll refer to that. If they need a forensic evaluation, I'll refer out for that. So it's best to take a team approach. I'm not at all trained to help somebody with a psychological issue, a medication issue, any of that stuff.
And so many of the people in prison have psychological problems. In fact, it's been pointed out that they have replaced mental hospitals in many cases. People act out.
Right.
They become public nuisances or they commit a petty crime. And then they are sent to prison and are medicated for all the time they're kept there.
They usually,
did you see that? In,
no, I didn't, because in federal prison, they are very tight with the meds. In state prisons, they're much looser. In federal prison, if you're going to a federal prison and you are, have a pre-established mental health condition, they're going to send you to a different type of facility. So they're not going to be at the facility that I was at. They're not going to be at a camp where you can walk around with unrestricted movement.
Well, are there any ex-cons on your group of experts, within your group of experts, people who've been to other kinds of prisons?
There are not. I have somebody on my team who was head of U.S. probation for a long time, but there's nobody who is like me. The reason being, there are rules that prevent us from having businesses and talking with each other for a period of time.
My guest is Wendy Feldman, who has started a business called Custodial Coaching, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Wendy Feldman, who has served 18 months at a federal prison camp, followed by a year in a halfway house, and then created a service for other people who have having similar kinds of experiences. Her service is called Custodial Coaching. What do you wish you had known before entering prison that you know now?
Oh, my gosh, it's a long list. I wish that I knew that what I try to teach my clients, really the key to surviving in prison is respect and humility. And I knew that intrinsically, but I had not practiced that.
Respect for whom?
In prison, you need to respect everybody's personal space, and you need to respect the staff. And that, in turn, you need to respect yourself. And
but
so,
they're not always going to respect you, are they?
Generally speaking, they do. Generally speaking,
well, you were in a women's facility.
It
might
facility.
Have been different if you were with some tough guys in a male prison.
But even in with the tough guys, and I've worked with some of them, respect is key. That's what they live by. And if you disrespect another guy, that's when you have trouble. So it's key no matter what type of prison you're in.
Were there any services that were available to you at that time?
I couldn't find any. My case went on for many, many years because it was very complicated. And during that time, I searched out to see if there was some sort of service like mine, and there just wasn't. I had good lawyers, and I was lucky. I had a very supportive family, but we did not have the one person who would kind of walk you through it, who'd been there and done that, who wasn't biased or angry. A lot of people come out, they're very angry.
What was a typical day? Did they try to teach you anything to help you after you got out?
I mean, a typical day in prison?
Mm-hmm.
No. A typical day in prison, you have a job. That job is just menial labor. And you have a lot of free time. So it's what you do with that free time that can really make you have a very boring, hard time, or it can change you. And so it's taking advantage of that free time to kind of improve yourself. There's no classes that they offer. I actually was a GED teacher, which was great because I got to help other people. But as far as vocational training or anything like that, there is not.
You have coined a word, incarcervention.
Right.
What does that mean?
I call incarcervention, it means a legal intervention. So I believe it works with people who are perpetual offenders. For example, take somebody who's in the news, who's always in trouble. Even Lawrence Taylor last year, he had done one type of crime, a fraud, then a drug crime, and then the crime last year. That's somebody who needed an incarcervention. It's really a wake-up call to say, if you keep doing this, something really drastic will happen.
Yeah, but I'm sure people say to Lindsay Lohan, you got to stop acting this way. And she doesn't seem to be able to do that.
Because she has
not. Or Amy Whitehouse.
Well, that was a little different. She wasn't necessarily breaking the law. She had a substance abuse problem. But with the Lindsay Lohan, she had not faced, and still hasn't, a drastic consequence. And so sometimes I can get with people and say, you're going to face this drastic consequence, and here's what you need to do to turn it around. And some people aren't going to listen to you. That's just like an intervention with a drug addict. Sometimes they're not going to listen.
At what stage do you start working with people after they've been convicted and sentenced?
It depends. I work with a lot of people pre-trial. They're going through the investigation. They haven't pled guilty yet, or they're going. I have three cases right now actually going to a real trial. They might settle at the end, so it just depends. If I work with them pre-trial, I'm trying to get the client to really tone themselves down and let some of their humility shine through. And sometimes I have to trick them into that because at that point they're very angry. And I have to get them to show some remorse. Remorse not for their crime, because they're going to still say they didn't do anything, but remorse for the choice that led them to this situation. So those are the pre-trial people. The post-conviction people are getting them ready to go to prison, and more importantly, getting them ready to come out.
That's the hardest part, you
That's
say.
The hardest part.
Really?
I say prison is
easy. Well, you
easy.
Went to a halfway house. Isn't that supposed to smooth the transition?
Halfway house is the most ridiculous thing that they have. A halfway house has people from all security backgrounds. So you will have somebody at a halfway house like me, and you'll have somebody who just did 30 years on a violent crime, and they're going to stick us all together. There's very little support. There's very little funding. And that's a big mess. It's supposed to be transitional living, but the reality is it's not.
What kind of practical advice can you offer for how to survive in jail? I mean, you mentioned respect.
Mm-hmm.
Is that simply it?
No, I think it's respect. It is really looking at the choices that got you there. And so some people will be adamant that they didn't do what it is that they're going to prison for. It's not about that. It's about something you did or some choice you made landed you there, whether it's wrong place, wrong time, hanging out with the wrong people, and just kind of reflecting on that makes your time easier. And then being busy. You have to be busy, read books, you know, exercise. You've got to be busy.
Well, there are some people who believe that going to jail should be a punishment, and exercise rooms and education and all of those things are, in a way, coddling prisoners.
A lot of people want to say that, and they want to look at prison as being strictly punitive. But the reality is, even in California, it used to be called the California Department of Corrections, and now they've changed the name. It's the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, because the bottom line is that almost everybody in prison is coming out, and 98% of those within 5 years. So we've got to look at that aspect of it. If you strictly punish people, then they're going to come out much worse than they came in, and they're going to reoffend.
And we've seen that. People come out, and within a couple of hours,
they're right back.
They've gotten a gun, and they're robbing a bank.
Right. So we have to kind of flip the switch, maybe, and focus on the reentry portion more so than the actual prison portion.
We tend to focus on hardships for the prisoner, but what difficulties do families face when a spouse or a parent winds up in jail?
You know, I say families are the forgotten consequences of crime. Because people, the person going to prison is focusing on themselves. The system is focusing on the person who's about to be an inmate, and the families really need support. Drug addict families have Al-Anon. There's not a support group that's great for people going to prison. I work with people's entire families because it's a huge thing. You need to support them because they are going to be the support of the person coming out of prison.
But what happens when you're sent far away? For example, you're from California. You were sent to Arizona. It's mm-hmm. the next state, but it's still not close. In New York, there's been a lot of talk about the fact that the prisons that people from New York City are sent to are upstate, and it's a real hardship for their families to get up to those prisons for visits.
It is a hardship, but there are other ways. Letters, believe it or not, in the age of the internet, going back to writing actual letters, and I encourage all of my clients to do it, and they wind up getting to know their family member on a different level because it's not the face-to-face. Sometimes they're afraid to have the face-to-face because they've harmed their family. So letters, anybody can write a letter.
Do prisons allow for conjugal visits?
Very few, and none in the federal system.
And what about I would assume that means that a lot of marriages or relationships fall apart while somebody's in jail.
It depends. I've seen relationships get stronger. I've seen them fall apart. It depends on the foundation of that relationship. It's a true test of not only your marriages, but your friends, your relationship with your family, your kids, all of that.
So now you've gotten out of prison.
Right.
Do you lose any rights if you've been convicted of a federal crime?
You lose voting rights for a certain period of time. Everybody is different. I gave up. I stipulated to giving up my securities license.
Could you have gone back to that?
Very doubtful. But I could be a consultant. I have no desire to be. I work with several lawyers and doctors who will be losing their professional licenses. So while that's not a civil right, that's going to be a consequence for them.
Are there disclosure obligations that you have
yes.
to make?
Yeah. In some cases.
So when you apply for a job?
You have to, it's called checking the box, and there's a big movement to take that away for somebody who's served all of their time and their probation. But right now, we have it.
Does the internet make it even more difficult for people to avoid having to reveal that they've been convicted of a crime?
It makes it harder to say what you actually did, but the fact of the matter is that with a live scan and with a background check, it's going to come up anyways.
Well, you were convicted as Wendy Perner, and now you're using your maiden name.
I was actually convicted under my maiden name as well.
Uh-huh. So that's part of the record.
Right.
Would you advise your clients to change their names?
It doesn't matter. I mean, it's going to come up no matter what under your Social Security number. So I tell them use whatever name you were using. And that I always went by in my business, Wendy Feldman.
You urge inmates to get real, get over it, and get home.
Yep. That's it.
That's it?
That's what I tell them to do.
And then they get home and they think, I'm not going back. I'm going to go straight. Mm-hmm. I'll never do that again. And then they can't get a job. There's a lot of tension in their home. This has to be a serious problem.
It's a very serious problem, but if they just get over it, what I mean by that is accept it. And not only accept it, learn from it. So it's not, for example, in my case, it's not the most pleasant thing to go through media and talk about what I did 10 years ago, but the fact of the matter is that's what happened. And if you don't learn from it, then that's really the crime. And so I encourage people when they come out. I know people who did very long prison stints who now are working at places like Target, like Home Depot, and have moved up into management level positions who had no job skills, no education, but they simply wanted to do it. So there's a different type of personality.
Are those companies likely to hire ex-cons?
A lot of them are. A lot of them are. And more and more so. I know Virgin, Richard Branson's company, is doing a big push to hire people like that. In some ways, it's a safer bet because you have somebody who's going to give you accountability and has learned that, hopefully, in prison.
It's been pointed out that if we didn't have harsh drug laws, the prisons would be a lot less full. But we're talking, and you were in a prison where many of the people had drug problems, others had committed white-collar crimes.
Yeah.
So we're talking about two very different kinds of situations. Are there programs that help people get past their drug problems?
Yeah, almost every prison has some kind of drug substance abuse counseling. And also don't forget that if you're in prison for a certain amount of time, that amount of time is usually a time of sobriety, and that helps people with their substance abuse as well.
And when you're dealing with people, do you deal with the criminal mind and the addictive mind separately or differently?
People say there are 8 patterns of criminal thinking, and so in some ways they overlap and in some ways they don't. I know a lot of people who did committed criminal acts who had no substance abuse problems, but most people do.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, there are mentally ill people in the prisons. How do we transition them out?
That's a completely different scenario, and it depends the level of their mental illness. So a DSM diagnosis will say that some people are mentally ill who have simply a DSM-4, a substance abuse diagnosis. So I think the number is misleading as far as the number of truly mentally ill who can go back onto the streets.
How do you measure the effectiveness of your program? Do you keep records on recidivism rates?
I keep in touch with almost all of my clients or their lawyers and see how people are doing. And generally speaking, people are doing pretty well. I don't have anybody who's gone back. I have a couple of people who just don't get that they can't bend the rules anymore, and we'll see what happens with them, but I don't think it's likely. And even the women that I was in prison with, the recidivism has been pretty low.
Well, recidivism is lower generally among women than men, isn't it?
It depends on the crime.
With drugs, of course, they go back again.
Right. It depends on the crime. You know, look at drug dealing is the federal, like you said, the federal prisons are full of that because there are mandatory sentencing laws. But we have a current trial right now with the Michael Jackson lawyer, and that's kind of drug dealing, only legal drug dealing. So if had that been a federal crime with illegal drugs, we'd be seeing a completely different scenario. So there's a disparity, and we have to bridge the gap there.
Wendy Feldman's counseling service is called Custodial Coaching. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.